Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Welcome to this week's episode of Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name is Kirk Chisholm and I will be your host today. So today we have another famous guest. We have John Snyson. How are you doing today, John?
I'm great. How about you, Kirk?
I'm a big fan of John's. He's a wealth of knowledge when it comes to the history of money and economics, and I'm really happy to get him on the show today. And John, maybe you can tell the guests a little bit about your background, because I'm sure you can speak much better about yourself than I can.
As anybody, I started this journey back in 2008. When I woke up, I read a book actually called Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and that totally eviscerated everything that I believed and understood about governments and money in total. So that really, you know, started the whole trickle into, you know, wanting to understand money and economics, because I was like hitting the wall. It's like, wow, you know, this is not what I thought it was. So I went into, you know, reading a whole bunch of economics. Well, actually, one of the first ones that really like inspired me was Mike Maloney's Investing in Gold and Silver. A little brief bit about monetary history, you know, what happened throughout history with money and currency and all that. So that really drawn me into that aspect. And of course, I love mathematics from a very early age. So really like money and economics, numbers, all this stuff, charts and everything really drove me into, you know, wanting to understand more and more about currency and money. So in 2008, I actually met my wife and I moved to Canada in 2009. And in 2009, I actually, when we did the whole paperwork with the government and everything, we did missed some check marks. And then, of course, I didn't have the permit to be able to work. So what I had to find is I had to see if I could work with someone that would let me work without a work permit. So I actually started to work in the investment world for a couple of years, selling what was called syndicated mortgages. So basically selling, you know, what is a product. It's basically can be used as mezzanine financing or other financing to pull people's money into and lend that to developers in real estate. So that's what I did for a couple of years. Learned a ton about, you know, the real estate markets and what was going on there during that time. And then just during that time as well, you know, I read probably like almost 100 books on different types of monetary history, everything from history of money all the way back to the Greek Empire. Great book is called Dark Pools, which talk about the rise of high frequency trading. And, you know, the reasons why we see what we see today going so fast up and down. I really just love understanding technology and money. And of course, throughout the time too, as well, I've been a telecommunication technician. So I understand the technological sides that are more and more merging with the whole market side. And you need to understand the both of them to really understand what they're doing on a grand scale. So yeah, over time, you know, I've been on about 800 videos now on different alternative medias. I've been on a whole bunch of mainstream medias here in Canada, and especially during the whole Bitcoin initial, like the 2018 bubble, everybody was calling to get me on and talk right at the peak of the bubble, of course, you know, because that's, you know, the sentiment of the psychology, of course, when it comes to markets. So yeah, I've been, you know, talking about this for many years. I've been speaking on conferences in four different countries, because I've been in Norway, in Mexico, Canada, and Sweden talking about the history of money and of course this new digital era that we're, you know, heading towards. So a lot about that. Now, you know, been writing two books, and then right now I do a couple of reports here and there that I try to make people understand the facts that is in place, because I don't sell anything, of course. It's only my opinions, but I use the statistical and historical facts to try to make people understand it better and make better decisions.
We were on a show a few weeks ago, on a YouTube show. We were talking beforehand, and I really want to dig into kind of the history of money, because I think a lot of people don't really understand how kind of money came about. And I guess some of the examples of when money was used poorly and how it ended up blowing up on them. So I kind of want to go back in time a little bit to talk about how maybe some of the more memorable examples of how money has not worked. I think what I really want to do here, just for the listeners' sake here, just so you understand, you know, we're at an interesting economic times right now. No one can deny what's going on, and they're printing money all over the place around the world, and it's a big experiment, and no one knows how this is going to end. And I think it's helpful to look at history to be instructive for what could happen. Doesn't mean it will happen, but it gives you an idea of what could happen, and it can help you protect yourself if, you know, certain things come to pass that may not be beneficial for people who are holding dollars or yen or whatever the currency may be. So, John, what are some of those your favorite examples in history where money has been used to a more tragic effect?
You know, ever since the start that we started to mint currency back in the Greek Empire, you know, the money exchangers and gold, what do you call goldsmiths back in the day, they had interesting ways of being able to trade money. They came up with interesting ways, and the kind of the early, like pre-banking kind of era where you put money into a deposit with a goldsmith, for example. But then, you know, at one point they started to think that, oh, well, you know, what I could do is I could probably create these little certificates of IOUs, basically, which the dollar and all other currencies are in their paper form. They started to make those. And over time, it's like, well, I'm doing okay, but I could print more of these, can't I? As long as I don't tell people that I have a lot more of these paper IOUs than I actually have physical gold in the storage, it's fine to just keep on doing that. And that comes to a point where, you know, there's too many of these IOUs in circulation so that people come in and want their gold back, but then they found out that there's no gold there. Very similar to the modern era, you know, deposits, you know, if you have a bank run with people wanting cash out of the bank doesn't have that much cash as it actually has physical deposits on demand. So the early ways, you know, it started with goldsmiths and so on. But then, of course, the governments like Greek government and the through the Roman era, you know, they actually used their currencies. They started with gold and silver minted currencies. And then, of course, over time, as they wanted to expand their empires and grow bigger, you know, it sounds kind of familiar to the United States where they expand their realm around the world with all their military bases and all this. You need money to do that, right? And if you just have a set supply of money, you can't just create that out of thin air. So what they did in the early days before paper money, and now, of course, the digital era, they started to debase the currency. So they took out, they had lesser and lesser content, for example, of silver. For example, one silver denarius back in year 212 had 90-something% silver. But then as you know, time went on, I think it was about 80 years later, that same silver denarius, you know, had a content of maybe like 5 or 10% or even less. And they went to just copper currency at one point in the Roman Empire. So it's very interesting how, you know, they do that, but they did that in order to be able to, you know, spend more as a government and be able to expand, you know, their control around the world as an empire. So that was, of course, the Roman Empire. We know all like the decline of empires always happen, and they always rise with the creation of a currency or money. So the first actual paper currency that was created in the world, they started early in China and over there with their skin money in the year 700s or so. But then they actually merged and they've created the first paper printed, like with actual, you know, being pressed on currency. And this was way before, you know, Goethe was around to actually print anything. They actually printed with their own ink. What they did is it was the Song Dynasty back in 1024. They created the first paper currency ever existed in history. And what they did with that currency initially, you know, it's interesting to the similarities to the US dollar. Back in the day, they didn't usually have gold or silver backing because they didn't have that much, especially in China, they didn't have that much of the currency. They more had copper. So what they did is they backed it against a certain amount, a percentage, you know, a percentage of coinage that they had, which was copper coinage. You know, backing that went well for a while. But then after, you know, in like 20 or so, 30 years, they started actually, you know, getting involved in lending that money out to everyone. And you had a, almost like an economic miracle that happened where people, you know, felt a lot wealthier. They started to really boom the economy. But at one point, they had to, you know, go into more and more of this because they started to charge interest on that. And so what happens throughout history when you charge interest, you get to a point where when you create money and you actually have the debt that you create, but then you have the interest. If you pay off all the debt, there's still interest left. And so that's the whole end of that system. But more and more people were, you know, getting and feeling more wealthier, getting into more debt, and they printed more of these. But at one point, that purchasing power, you know, really started to show in the markets and the economy where, you know, they weren't able to get, you know, near as much anymore for the paycheck. I don't know exactly like what they, you know, how they got paid. They still labor and so on, but not on the scale that we have today. But they got paid, and as the goods, you know, the currency that they used to save up and then buy things got less and less valuable over time, people would be like, well, you know, what are we going to do here? You know, our the currency that you issue, the emperor that in the Song Dynasty, why are you, continuing this? And actually, at one point, they had to go away from the backing of coinage that was 30%, and now there's just pure fiat, which basically means it's backed by nothing. And it's, of course, it was law throughout that time. So it actually said on the bill that they had, if you do, counterfeit this bill, you will get your head chopped off. So it's a little bit worse than it is today. Today you get put in prison. But so that was, the first actual bill. And of course, as they raised, they became a very, huge dynasty. But then the Mongols, saw over time that they became weaker because their currency started to, really weaken in purchasing power. And that's when, the Mongols attacked and they had to just, in order to protect themselves, they had to, print mass amounts of currency in order to buy military equipment and so on. And that's what really created the real hyperinflation that just, devastated the currency. And it lasted till 1127. So it lasted about 103 years. And after that, they had several other empires. You had, of course, the next one is the Qin government. Same thing happened. That one was actually less than, like, it was 80 years that it lasted, the currency. Then the next one was, this was another one that was there. It was a Southern Song Dynasty, and that one lasted about 150 years. So they were a little bit more pertinent with the amount that they could print the money. And then, of course, after that, you had the Yuan Dynasty, which really were terrible at managing their money. Their currency that they created lasted from 1227, but then they actually failed around 1280. So it actually failed. It just completely lost value, vertically. And it was a revaluation basically of a currency. And there's so many examples of that in modern history. Like Argentina has done that, 8 times throughout the last 100 years, where they basically overnight, the currency is worth way less now.
So it sounds like, a lot of these currencies, and there's countless examples in history, but it sounds like these currencies don't really last much longer than 100 years. And then there's this debasement that happens. Does that sound about right?
That's actually a very fair observation. And it actually is very similar to every currency around the world. Like whenever there's an empire, they usually last between, anywhere from 100 to 150, maybe 200 years at the top end. But that's usually the lifespan, and they live and die mostly with the value of their currency or money, which is very interesting.
Just because I think it's helpful for the listeners to understand, they're probably thinking, what does this mean for me? So I think the question I would ask you is, that's great. So it lasts 100 to, let's say, 200 years as the max. So what happens if a currency starts to go into decline? What are indications that this is happening, and what are things that people should watch out for?
One of the number one things that happen is you hit what I call peak debt, where basically there's nobody else that can take on more debt. The economy is drained, the amount of paychecks and everything that we have doesn't account to, as much debt that we have. So we basically go into default mode. And you have these cycles so many times, especially with the creation of the Federal Reserve, a central bank, you have these cycles almost every 7 years, which is called a business cycle. And that's how, everybody overextend themselves on debt to a point where they actually can't service that debt anymore. And then they default on that debt. That is, the turning point in the most recent, 400, 500 years of history, where you actually get to the point where you just have too much debt, oversaturated with debt, and you just can't pay it anymore. And that's when you really start to see a deflationary decline. But then, of course, the central entities usually panic, and then they just start printing currency more and more in order to be able to make the currency less and less worth, so you could keep on borrowing more money over time. And that's the whole scheme. Like, that's why you have, the drive for the need for inflation always. You have an inflation target of 2% with the Federal Reserve. They always need to grow the monetary supply, because if you go in default, you got to remember, when you print currency out of thin air, like the central bank does, together with the U.S. Treasury going into deficit spending, you actually create the debt. But on top of that, there's actually an interest rate, on all the bonds that gets created. And that is where the problem is, because you always have to increase the monetary supply. Let's start at the basics. So $100, you started with borrowing you $100, you got to pay me back, let's say, 1 or 2 or 5% on that, on interest that I want, but there's only $100 in existence. So what do you got to do then? Well, you got to come back to me and say like, John, can you print me another, you know, $5 or so because I need to pay off the interest, whatever. So it's very similar to a Ponzi scheme where you have to continuously increase the monetary supply through debt creation. And that's why you see the Federal Reserve, you know, have to buy up the assets. They can't just let them default in there right now. And I think so, that's the biggest warning.
Let's look at this in a few scenarios, right? So all throughout history, the result has been the same. The government's getting into trouble and then they just start printing wildly to try to bail themselves out. What would happen if they didn't do that? What are they afraid of?
They're afraid of what's called deflationary pressure, where actually the currency will strengthen in value and everything becomes less and less costly. But the problem is that if you have debt, you know, if you set with debt, you racked up all this debt and you get that deflationary pressure as your income goes down over time because currency gets more and more valuable, basically that debt that you have is never going to be able to be paid back because of that deflationary state. And that creates, you know, what you see as defaults now and everything into the economy.
Now, I would argue that, well, if things are getting cheaper, that's probably a good thing.
I would love to see that.
Right.
But yeah, that's not what they believe in.
Right. But then defaults, I mean, isn't that a natural course of economics where, you know,
well, this current monetary cycle, you have to have defaults because you over exaggerate on debt and then you have a natural collapse of whoever has too much debt. Yeah.
I mean, obviously they're really afraid of that, but other than defaulting on debts, like let's look at Japan. They're probably right now the best example of deflation going on in the world. You know, unless you have a better example, that's a pretty notable one. It's been there for decades. People look at Japan. Japan seems to be fine. You know, their economy seems to be okay. They've been in deflation for what, 30, 40 years? What's so bad about that?
Their yen is actually, for example, it's, you know, hundreds of thousands of yen right now because they printed a lot of currency. And of course, the central bank has been in there, you know, buying up every single asset that they can. They hold stocks, they hold bonds, they hold ETFs. They just had to do that because you had a natural saturation, but also another important cycle that I didn't mention, you know, is the demographic cycle of people aging, because that's a natural deflationary pressure. As, you know, people get older, they, you know, sell their assets because they retire and they need to be able to get those off the books. But the problem is going to be when there's not enough young people to actually buy those assets, then the central bank stepped in, right? And they had to buy everything, but they never, like the economy and their stock market has never really gone above or the peak in the 80s. You had just like a stagnation in the economy, as they call it. But, you know, people are still fine. But of course, for major reasons, I don't want to live in Japan. But, you know, it's not bad to have that. But the problem is you still like have that balance between, you know, the paychecks of the people and the inflation that you create by, you know, issuing, because some of that money that they buy, you know, they buy all these stocks and then they give the banks fresh currency that they put in as a deposit. So money eventually trickles into the economy and create, you know, inflation for the people locally. And having a cheap currency, you know, is the best of things because then everybody wants to buy from you. But, you know, for the people themselves, you know, savings in Japan is not very well. Like, try to save bonds that are negative yielding. Of course, you know, when you look at the ownerships of other things as well, you know, real estate and everything is down. So compared to the rest of the world, because the rest of the world is, we're in the same boat here, you know, Japan is not doing that well. Even though that people can, you know, get along and survive there, they're still not doing fantastic.
And it kind of brings up the topic of debt too, right? Because they've got, what, 450% of GDP is in debt, something like that, some crazy.
Yeah, around there, like all debt, when you talk about all debt, they bought, you know, 250. They have like 250% debt to GDP, just like the government debt to GDP, of course. So yeah, you have like the monetization of debt that these central banks create. And I just feel like it's unsustainable to just do that. And you basically are destroying savers that will be able to. In the old days, if you have like a stable system that you just have a set currency amount, you'd be able to save up over time and then buy a house cash. Like over time, as this progresses, then there's so much currency in supply. And people are, you know, salaries are not increasing with the amount of real inflation. That's the reason why you have people having to buy, you know, they have like now 30, 40 year mortgages. They have like car loans, you know, goes from being cash payment over to, you know, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, 8 years, 10 years now, right? So you're seeing an unsustainable rise. That's, you could keep on monetizing and buy this debt forever and never go bankrupt as a government, but you will destroy the purchasing power for the people. And at a certain point, the people could, you know, say that I'm not going to use this currency anymore. I just want something else. And that's when they usually fail and go into usually a hyperinflation of some sorts, where the government just got to print excessive amounts of electronic money to pay off all the debt that exists and so on. And people don't use it. We actually had a electronic central bank currency that was created in Ecuador in 2014. Nobody used it. And so it failed in 2018. They had to shut down the electronic currency project there. They actually tried to do what we're seeing the Federal Reserve is talking about, and a lot of Canadian banks are, and central banks and other places around the world are talking about. And that's kind of the weapon that they need to put in, is they need to go into a cashless system in order to protect the banking system itself here and be able to manipulate it.
And that brings up an interesting concept of where digital currency, and we see Bitcoin and all these other ones, and the government seem to be against all that, yet they're, from what I hear, they're building their own. So A, why would they do that? And B, what are the problems? What is that going to solve for these governments?
There's a book out there called The Curse of Cash by Kenner Rogoff, and he lays out every single issue that has been talked about. Some of them are, of course, in that book. Is the number one thing that he is wanting to happen with the digital currency is that the governments around the world would have way easier access to you, as everything is digital and they have everything on a ledger somewhere that they could control and see what you used, what you got paid and all this stuff. So they could easily, you know, tax you. That's the number one thing. And then the second and most important thing is to prevent bank runs. Throughout history, there's been, you know, hundreds upon hundreds, probably thousands of bank runs. As we said in the beginning, you know, you had deposits at the bank. When you deposit money into the bank, it's not yours anymore. You're borrowing it to the, you're lending it to the bank, right? So what happens then is that eventually, you know, that today's banks, you know, they're not like the savings and loan banks back in the day where they go and, you know, borrow the money to people to buy mortgages and so on. Now they're in the stock market, you know, they're investing in derivatives and they're making crazy bets and so on with, you know, your deposit money that you deposited. And then of course they have limited amount of physical cash. So the physical cash that's, you know, in place, probably like in most banks, you're looking at maybe 1 to 3% max, probably even lower mostly, and also in credit unions. So what they're afraid of is that people physically will go to the ATMs and take out, you know, X amount of money. And let's say that 5% of people took out their deposits. The bank is done almost. So there's a huge risk there, of course, and that's one of the major reasons why they want to go into a digital era. And then the other thing that he talked about was, of course, you know, it's germs all over these bills that, you know, can flow in between people. So it's a huge hazard. You know, that's why a lot of people, a lot of businesses here in Canada, is not accepting physical cash anymore. Several other things too, but the most important things is that, and it's actually like they're saying it's to stop terrorists and evil money launderers and traffickers and all this stuff. But meanwhile, it's mostly for, you know, them being able to collect taxes better and then to protect the banks from, you know, insolvency.
This is the part I never understood. So you have a digital currency. Why do we need a bank if we're not depositing monies there? I mean, I know that they're afraid of this. Yeah. And yet, at the same time, they're trying to come up with their own digital currency. So why do you need a bank if you have a digital currency?
No, exactly. 100%. I totally 2,000% agree with that, because now you basically can hold a wallet on your own computer and everywhere, right? And of course, with the cryptocurrencies that are out there, you know, you could freely transfer person to person without the need of a third party, as the banks are, right? So, but they don't want to give away that power. They want that centralized currency that you still have to have deposits somewhere where they can control it. So they're very afraid of the people actually going out and physically, you know, we don't need you anymore. So I could send currency to you. I could send money to my family, you know, in Norway very easily without, you know, massive wire transfer cost and so on, because that really cuts up the middleman of the whole system with this new decentralized and distributed systems that, you know, are coming out, and not the digital currencies that the central banks want, because they are totally centralized and controlled by them.
I mean, digital currency aside, because I think from what I've been hearing, there are a few countries out there, I believe India and China, who would have a digital currency ready to go, assuming that they wanted to do that. You know, not every country has that, so that makes that process interesting. But you look at countries like Venezuela, which is, I guess, our most recent victim of poorly managed currencies. What went wrong there? And you hear stories about it's a socialist country and that there's no food on the shelves and really having a tough time there. I mean, people are starving. And what made that go wrong? Like, what did they do from a monetary perspective that kind of doomed them for this challenging situation?
Exactly what happened was that they were dependent on oil royalties. They actually ran the budget on that the price of oil would be around $130. And so when the oil price dropped down to, like, initially, this was back in, I forgot the exact year, but I think it was 15
in December, and then,
Yeah, exactly. So when that happened, you know, all your income dwindles up and disappears. So what did they have to do? Because they didn't, you know, have a proper system where they actually could, you know, tax people more or anything to actually, you know, raise the government income. They had to physically go out there and print currency into existence in order to keep up the shortfall and you know, be able to centrally plan and pay people everywhere in the government and also pay people in the economy. So they had to do that because when you're dependent, heavily dependent on royalties to actually fund your government, that is a very dangerous position to be when you're dependent on a physical commodity that could, you know, with supply and demand over time, and especially now during the coronavirus, just plummets and go to negative even. I actually wrote about that in 2015, warning about that. This will create a hyperinflation in Venezuela because how are they going to pay for things with the only thing that they're dependent on for income is, you know, oil prices to fund their government spending.
It's certainly a great example of that. What about, you know, a lot of people are worried about the amount of debt that's being created for the coronavirus crisis from 2008. I mean, there's massive amounts of debt being created. So why doesn't the U.S. go into hyperinflation because we're just basically printing money like they are?
It's a little bit different with the United States. With Venezuela, too, another thing was that they had a lot of denominated debt in other currencies. As this happened, you know, they had issues with, you know, their debt basically becoming extremely unsustainable, as I said. With their currency losing value, they couldn't pay back the debt whatsoever. So that was the number one thing. With the United States, that makes them a little bit better is that they actually, you know, physically print everything and have it in dollar-denominated debt. So they could keep on with that whole thing and get into mass amounts of debt to, you know, their teeth. But what is happening over time, and this is a chart that people should go and look up. They could go to the St. Louis Fed for this. It's called fred.stlouis.org, and it's /series/M2V. That is the monetary velocity. So how, you know, much money actually circulates through the economy. A healthy economy, you know, you have money changing hands from, you know, as it gets created into debt, you know, moves around in the economy really, really well. But what has ended up happening with the United States creating all this debt and then buying, you know, the assets, what they're doing is they actually, the banks are, you know, as they're buying the assets, they're giving the banks fresh money, but that is put as on deposits at the Federal Reserve for X amount of interest that they can, you know, give them. And it doesn't, you know, move into the economy whatsoever. A second thing is that also the United States has shipped a lot of their debt overseas. Mass amounts of, you know, their currency is overseas with, you know, $6-7 trillion something in bonds that are being held, you know, by China, by Japan, and by a whole major array of other Western countries. The thing is, if you actually took that money and moved that money right into the economy where people are spending it and using it, you know, you would have an hyperinflation on your hands very, very fast. The thing is, though, it has moved in, but you did see, though, not hyperinflation, but very high inflation, not so much in real estate, but in the stock markets. You know, stock markets raised like crazy because they used debt to buy stocks and they used debt to, you know, go on margins and increase the amount of currency that are chasing the same assets in the stock market. So that's why you saw, you know, massive inflation. I call it inflation. It's not, you know, percentage rise of stocks. It doesn't really change. Like if you actually took a stock and looked at it, you know, if you just looked at it against a fixed value object or something, the stock wouldn't probably change that crazy much. Of course, there's growth in companies and companies get bigger and take over things. But, you know, over time, it's not as great of a gain really against the paper currency that you're measuring it against, because it's like basically you're trying to use a measurement like a measuring stick, and and it changes every day. So you can't build, how can you build a house with, you know, measuring with a changing target measurement all the time? That doesn't make sense. And that's what's, you know, happening with currencies, that it constantly changes. But you haven't seen the amount of inflation because of, you know, the two major things that, you know, it doesn't trickle into the real economy.
Let's talk about bailouts for a minute, because we just had this huge crisis and Fed is, well, let's just say there's lots of money. I mean, the government programs and the, you know, the Fed's in there buying all this debt and supporting the economy. What are all these bailouts, which are, you know, make 2008 look like a, you know, like a small party? What is this going to do to our economy at this point?
You're basically making people and businesses and everybody dependent on bailouts, because first of all, you know, nobody is able to work. And like the government think that, you know, they're going to, you know, keep on giving you money. I think this is the start of what you call universal basic income, probably in a lot of countries, because they got to keep those people that lost all those jobs now that are never going to come back. A lot of businesses are shuttering. You know, in China, I just watched Wuhan that reopened their economy. They're saying that at least 20 to 30% of all the restaurants that were there, they're gone forever. And a lot of businesses as well, because first of all, people are not going to just move into the economy and, you know, start spending a whole bunch of money. They're going to actually, you know, spend less as, you know, they're getting some of the stimulus. A lot of the stimulus are sometimes loans. If those loans, and of course with the banks, you know, that you currently keep, you know, getting more interest on that debt as you defer payments here in Canada, for example. So you still have, you know, the rise of debt levels are still increasing. If you look at the, what's called M2 and M3 monetary supply, it's all the currency that exists in a country. You actually see that that is slightly increasing all the time as the stimulus packages are, you know, getting shoved out there. But the problem is you could keep on, you know, stimulating the economy and, you know, bailing out everybody left, right, and center. The problem is you're creating zombies. And that's what happened with, you know, a lot of corporations in the United States. There was $10 trillion at the peak of corporate debt that was made available. And of course, a lot of, you know, the share stock prices was used by, you know, getting into debt and then buying back your own shares. But all that debt has become and created people that are not able to pay that money back. So, for example, you know, governments and corporations, I think it was like somewhere around 15%. That's not completely accurate number, but that were zombie companies. So basically a zombie corporation is, or a company or a government is somebody that only pays interest on the debt. They can't pay down the principal on the debt. So they just manage by servicing the, you know, the interest payments on the debt. And then I think you're going to see a lot more of that in the economy, where you could keep on, you know, bailing out people left, right, and center. But what you're doing is you're really distorting real market economics, where you shove money in and give people a currency that probably shouldn't have had it because they mismanaged their company. And they would have been, you know, as we said, these debt cycles, these business cycles and everything else would sort itself out. Instead, you know, they're not willing because they need to keep inflation rising. They need to bail them out in order to, you know, constantly increase the supply of currency, because they're, you know, deathly afraid. It was Ben Bernanke said it in a 2002 speech. Deflationary pressures comes in. We could take comfort in that the pressure of the printing presses always win over deflation. So that's what you're going to see. Basically, you know, they're going to keep on printing tons of currency, but at one point you could print all this currency, but what you're doing is you're putting a wedge between the rich and poor side, and you're devastating the middle class, because the middle class either becomes richer, you know, and ends up on the other side, or they become way poorer. A lot of them, unfortunately, are becoming way poorer because they can't sustain their debt levels that they have. So you're creating a huge diversion. The more and more currency that you print, because stock markets and everything and other assets are going up, that they're propping those up, and that's very few people, like the everyday person that's in those markets, right? So what you're creating is you're creating a huge diversion of more income inequality by this currency printing over time. And then you get riots like you have in France. France is just terrible, you know, with their currency. There's people there that are protesting out in the street because they can't pay for getting food. Number two reason, there was a tax increase. It was a basically a carbon tax that they tried to implement. And that was the straw. You know, they didn't have enough currency. And you're getting the pressure from the inflation, but also from the taxes. Who's going to pay for all of this, right? At the end, they're going to have to raise taxes, or they're just going to believe that they can print it to oblivion? I don't think so. Like, you can only go to a certain point where that breaking point is, where people are starving in the streets because you have distorted, where you have stagnant or even slowing down wages, but you have the increase of prices and everything is going up and people are just falling further and further behind. Most of people, right?
That's a great point, because a lot of what's going on is creating some of these divisions between the rich and poor and destroying the middle class. And people think it's politics, but it's not. It's really money and what's going on with the money and debt that's being created in society. We got to wrap it up here in the interest of time, but I really enjoyed having you on, John. Any kind of final thoughts? And then where can people find more about you and your books? And this has really been a great chance to chat with you.
Final thoughts is, you need to, like in these days, you need somebody that understands. If you don't understand money yourself or all the stuff that we're talking about, you need somebody to help protect you from that risk. And of course, guys like you and Tim and others that I know that are actual advisors that are not. We're not talking about the general advisor, but people that actually study history and study cycles, study real economics, they understand and can position themselves to, you know, put people at a better place. And what I try to do as well is I try to, you know, come up with my ideas and my understanding of history and put forth data that, you know, for like the real current time, and try to make sense out of it all for people. Like, it's just basically me, myself, trying to make sense of it myself. But then I also, you know, are able to put my information out, because all the work that I put into that, to the regular everyday person, so they actually could be able to get a better understanding and become financially literate. You know, it's the biggest crime of the century, not teaching understanding money or economics in schools. It's just a fraud in my point of view. So I think it's very important that we, like, to take from all of this is to, you know, you need to educate yourself and just understand at least basics, so you can see through all of this, you know, things that are happening. Because if you don't see through it, you're going to become a huge victim of them if you get stuck in, you know, your, like what you hear at mainstream media, because they're just pumping up whatever the corporations and the financial industry wants you to put your money into, so they could exit out of those investments. Yeah, I believe that's where, you know, it all ends, that you need to take care and understand money and economics. And of course, that brings me back to what I do. You could find my work at theeconomictruth.org. I have a couple of reports. I actually had a report on the real estate bubble in Australia there, which is really great. I actually gave people an understanding of what actually currently is happening in Australia, because you've seen banks are starting to struggle and the real estate market are crashing there. Also, I have, of course, my book, Canada, the Greatest Economy in the World? And the question mark was the debt levels that the private sector has here in Canada. And that is the most important part, is we don't care about the government. You know, it's like Krugman, he says, like, oh, debt is money we owe to ourselves. That's if you are the government and, you know, print your own currency. That's not if I'm Joe Blow, you know, owning money for a car or a house. I don't owe that to myself. That's a kind of warning about that. And of course, my last book is The End of Freedom, How Our Monetary System Enslaves Us, where I talk about monetary history, you know, ever since, you know, the Greek, back to the Greek empires, all the way to modern day era. And then lately, but lastly, I have one great last report called Global Risk Report 2020, where I go into and look at all kinds of markets, everything from cryptocurrency to real estate, to bonds, to stocks and everything, and try to make sense out of it all and look at some of the potential risks that are there. And one of them, of course, I was warning about derivatives like CLOs that would implode. And now you're seeing the bailouts basically buying in Canada and other places are buying the collateralized loan obligations, which are basically the same thing as the CDOs and the mortgage-backed securities back in 2008, just for corporations. So yeah, you could find everything. I put out a newsletter a couple of times a year, you know, to people as well. So people could sign up there and get all the information there. And one last thing, I have something called bankrun.org, which is basically a site where I try every week or so, go out there and look for news and everything happening around the world about risks in banks around the world.
That was a great interview with John. I really enjoyed that. I have to say, I love the intellectual stimulation from talking to people like him. You may listen to that interview and say, yeah, but how does that actually apply to me? For me, I could just think about these things all day long because they're just fascinating, because no one knows the future. So we try to think about what those scenarios and outcomes could be. But I think it's important to understand history. So as I say, you're not doomed to repeat it. So getting into the panel portion of our show, we have our returning panelist, Barbara Friedberg. How you doing today, Barb?
I'm doing good, Kirk. Thanks for having me on.
Glad to have you on and really interested to hear what you have to say about this episode. I know we had some good pre-show chatter here. We also have another returning panelist, Megan Gorman.
How you doing? Hi, Kirk. I'm doing well. How are you?
Doing great. We also have another returning panelist, Tim Pichot. How you doing today, Tim?
As good as you can be doing for spending the last 2 weeks moving in 100-degree weather. Glad to be done with that.
I'm glad they allowed you to move. My state, they'd probably arrest you if you left your house.
Well, we have guns here in this state and you guys don't, so.
Yes, two very different political sides in that argument. So let's get to it. So this was a really interesting conversation with John. I know, Tim, you actually know John very well, which is one of the reasons we were able to get John on the show. I know he's in high demand right now. What are your thoughts based on the conversation we had with John in terms of the history of money? I know you have some pretty good thinking around that.
John's one of my best friends. I talk with him almost every day, a brilliant mind. But when it comes to the history of money, I think people tend to forget history. I mean, even 12 years post the financial crisis, I mean, obviously now, you know, people have financial crisis on their mind, but 4 months ago, they didn't. And a lot of the issues that had crept up in 2008 were creeping up again. John and I actually were doing some podcasts actually in February, kind of before a lot of this all kicked off, talking about things like collateralized loan obligations and even like tinkering around on the Bank of International Settlements website where they were having emergency meetings on CLOs or collateralized loan obligations. And this is right as everything is starting to really kick off. By having somebody like John who's able to really parse through the data